Blog Talk Radio.
To the Global Product Management Talk, a regular broadcast for passionate product professionals and business people that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in product talks in person, so we bring product talks to you wherever you are. Every episode, we discuss different aspects of what it takes to produce successful products. Everyone is invited, including agile practitioners, user experience designers, content and community managers, business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, social media strategists, innovation managers, business analysts, project managers, product managers, program managers, product marketing managers, brand managers, software developers, and you, as well as everyone involved with the entire product lifecycle process from inception to sunsetting. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. That's our website, www.prodmgmttalk.com. Follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK and use the hashtag to tweet answers to the questions and follow the tweets, # PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you to our broadcast sponsor, Atlassian. Software is transforming the world. Atlassian is helping transform the teams building it. Atlassian helps innovators everywhere plan, build, and launch great software. Find out why more than 21,000 companies of all sizes use Atlassian issue tracking, collaboration, and software development products to work faster and smarter together. Visit Atlassian.com, Atlassian.com. Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Discover how to work together to develop amazing products. Startup Product Summit, February 7th, 2013. Startupproduct.com. Thank you to our platinum sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Visit them on the web, www.aipmm.com. The AIPMM is a worldwide certifying body of product marketing, management, and team professionals. The AIPMM promotes worldwide excellence and forwards product management professionalism with certification credentials, education, trainings, networking, and professional growth opportunities. AIPMM membership benefits include eligibility for certification, partner offerings and training discounts, productivity tools, career center, mentor matching, advanced access to new curriculums, webinar series, thought leaders, and private events. AIPMM certification credentials allow individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views newsletter, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Follow at AIPMM on Twitter. This is Cindy F. Solomon, your host for the Global Product Management Talk, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon and on the web, cindyfsolomon.com. Hello and welcome. This is Cindy live on this foggy, rainy Monday morning in California. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Sean Campbell, who is the co-founder of Cascade Insights, and we'll be talking about competitive intelligence frameworks. for deciphering changing market forces and customer needs. By the way, last week we got over 23,000 listeners on the broadcast. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you want to get in touch with me, just send an email to info@prodmgmttalk.com. By the way, our website was down, but all you have to do is search for PRODMGMTTALK on the web, and you will find us and follow us on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. To gain a business advantage in today's market, one must not only be quick, agile, and in tune with customers, but must also have a solid understanding of where the competition is at and where it is heading. Product managers need a rich analytical toolbox in hand so they can better understand their market, react to changing customer needs, and grow their overall share of the market. Knowledge of specific competitive intelligence frameworks and how to apply them will better enable product professionals to analyze competitors, develop winning strategies, and build better products. Our speaker today, Sean Campbell, is a co-founder of Cascade Insights, and he has a regular podcast called Competitive Intelligence Life with his partner, Scott Swigart. Sean is principal of Cascade Insights, and he acquired his expertise in competitive intelligence from nearly 20 years of working with leading-edge hardware and software technologies long before they became mainstream. As a recognized thought leader in the competitive intelligence community, he is regularly requested to speak at national events on competitive intelligence and industry analysis. He received the Catalyst Award from Strategic and Competitive Intelligence Professionals and co-chaired the Oregon SCIP chapter. Additionally, he is a contributing assistant professor at Willamette University's Atkinson Graduate School of Management, where he teaches industry analysis and competitive intelligence. You can follow him on Twitter at Sean, S-C-A-N, underscore Campbell, C-A-M-B-B-E-L-L. Sean, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Cindy.
Thanks for hanging in there.
Yeah, no problem. I've also, just FYI, too, I've got Scott Swigart, my business partner, here with me as well. And so, Scott, why don't you say hello as well?
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Scott. Hey, would you introduce yourself? I'm sorry I don't have the blurb on you. I didn't know you were coming. Great to have you.
No problem. Scott Swigart, Sean's business partner. I focus a little more on some of the things that require programming and analytics in our business. But otherwise, Sean and I are fairly interchangeable.
That's great. Well,
yeah, no, that's, you know, Scott and I worked together for 14 years. We had a previous company we grew and sold, and so we've, you know, we're kind of like a old married business couple, you know, in the joking sense. You know, we are married to someone else, you know, each of us. But the fact is that's kind of how it ends up being after you've kind of been together for 14 years in a good way. So, yeah, no, and thanks for having us on the podcast, and we'll kind of both chime in, or, you know, amplify or add to each other's answers as we kind of go along.
So usually, you know, we originated as a Twitter chat without an audio, and we still have the Twitter chat going on the background if I can go out there and tweet. But really, it's become more of a radio show. Although it is still set up as a Socratic format, so I did pre-post the questions that you provided for people to answer. But I really wanted to, before we go deep into the frameworks, could you give us for the listeners who aren't familiar with what exactly competitive intelligence is?
Yeah, sure. It's it's not being a spy. Although I think that's probably the first thing people always bring up. Are you a spy? And I'm like, no, I'm not a spy. It's not that exciting. Essentially, competitive intelligence is a discipline that provides decision support that then impacts strategy, product development, marketing decisions, sales decisions, right? So, and we've worked with all those different groups by providing insights to them over the years. We've seen CI teams grow attached to product groups, attached to sales teams, attached to marketing teams, attached to corporate strategy teams, et cetera. I mean, one of the simplest ways to describe it is, you know, you're looking outward for opportunity. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of teams that look inward, right? You've got market research teams that basically analyze typically your own customer base, their trends, their perceptions, tracking studies, et cetera. You know, competitive intelligence teams, we're always looking outward for what opportunities, you know, might exist for the company, as well as what threats might impact them. So, and the tools for that, you know, run the gamut, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit. But you know, at a high level, that's what it's about.
Got it. So could you tell me what would a CI person be? A business analyst? Are they distinct roles?
It's not so much a business analyst, although there's skill set that maybe comes from that. Basically, the best analog out there for any kind of profession is really kind of investigative reporter, business investigative reporter. So not somebody who's doing investigative work on the local police department, you know what I mean? But somebody who's doing really good business investigative reporting. A lot of the skill sets are similar, right? And so in terms of titles in a company, though, it's everything from people that have strategy in the title, that have analysts in the title, that in some, many cases they have something, some derivative of competitive or, you know, compete or something like that kind of in their title. And their goal usually is to, as one guy we work with one time said, you know, we fly MiGs. We're the red team. We fly the other guy's product. We use the other guy's service. We engage with the other guy's customers to then provide insights to other parts of the company so they can really understand what the, you know, strengths and weaknesses are of the competitor. And, you know, and it's not uncommon for somebody to come with an MBA background into this, or to somebody have a lot of industry expertise in a particular industry, and then kind of use that to essentially be the starting point from where they kind of move into a competitive intelligence role. And it's usually not, though, a new grad role. It's not usually a, you know, kind of position you usually put kind of a junior person in. More often than not, somebody's had at least a fair amount of time in industry before they take on a role like this.
So it's a seasoned strategic role.
Yeah. I mean, basically. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I mean, your toolbox is everything from classic business frameworks that go back all the way to things like Porter's Five Forces. You're using, you know, frameworks that have become popularized, like a technology adoption lifecycle type of framework to put things in perspective. That's all like the industry analysis kind of level. And then you're also doing things that are analogous to what you would hear of from almost like a public sector agency. You know, you develop human intelligence sources, you develop open source intelligence sources, you do a lot of benchmarking and, you know, using existing product to determine where it sits. But the end goal, you know, isn't just a briefing book for briefing's book's sake or a presentation for presentation's sake. I mean, you're really trying to impact the decisions the company's making and their direction so that, you know, they can, you know, be more profitable, make more money, and, you know, beat the competition.
So what size companies and or industries do you see competitive intelligence prevalent in?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the short answer is I think, and I know this is going to sound like everybody says this, right? But the reality is everybody worries about competitors, right? So if you're two guys in a pen and you just launched a company, you worry about competitors to a degree. I mean, there's always that kind of you know, thing you hear people say of, you know, if you just build a great product, you don't have to worry about everybody else. Well, yeah, that's kind of true. It's always been kind of true. You know, you still have to worry about competitors. If nothing else, just worrying about the fast follower who's trying to mimic exactly what you are doing. So, you know, there's always that. Now, if you get to the point of take the next step up, when does somebody have it as like part of their job? It says, I do competitive intelligence or whatever that company uses as kind of an analog for that as a term. You're probably at least, you know, a couple hundred people probably before somebody's got like quarter time, half time on their job. smaller companies, they're always thinking about it, and we may do training or kind of strategy sessions with them, but it's usually with the CEO or the VPs in a smaller company because they are always worried about the competition and kind of growing their market and that kind of thing. When you get bigger and you get to like Fortune 1000, Fortune 500, which is a lot of our clients. I mean, we work with Microsoft and Symantec and WestJet and Merck and 3M and, you know, all kinds of companies like that too. They will have whole teams dedicated to that. I mean, I think one of the largest dedicated centralized teams we ever saw was about 30 people in a pharma company that were all CI folks. So you can get to some pretty large teams, but in how they're structured just kind of depends on the company. Sometimes they're embedded in different product groups. Sometimes they're kind of centralized. It just depends on a little bit more culturally how the company is than anything else at that point.
Got it. So for product managers, you know, in small companies and in startups, the product manager needs to be everything except for the builder or the coder and the CEO. If there is a product manager on a startup team, so they're also expected to provide the competitive intelligence necessary for that startup to get to product market fit.
Sure. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, and I think, you know, one kind of piece of, you know, free advice that we always tell a team, no matter how big they are, right? Because we've done projects direct for product management teams inside large and small companies too, right? Probably the biggest thing they struggle with at times is actually getting hands-on experience with the other product. It's so easy to basically just use your own product, dog food it over and over and over again. And you have this generalized sense of what it's like to use the competition's product. Or maybe you used it once, two revs ago. But if you don't have like a compete lab and you don't really have a structured way of saying they just rolled out something new, what does that really look like to use or experience, you know, if it's a service? You're really doing yourself a disservice because, you know, your customers and the ones that you want to get that aren't your customers yet, they're doing that in a lot of cases. So, you know, we find companies, they kind of almost put these blinders on themselves and they do it to themselves. And it's probably the biggest thing we tell product management teams that they need to enable is that kind of work. I mean, we were down at a well-recognized company in the Valley. I mean, it's in the Fortune 300, I think. And there were about 40 of their product managers in the room for a training we were delivering on how to kind of fold CI into the product management discipline. And, you know, it's amazing to me how many different times people basically think it's, a kind of unique idea to essentially build a lab of the other guy's products. And to me, I guess, I mean, maybe it's just being an entrepreneur, I'm always thinking, I always want to know what the other guy's doing. Why wouldn't I invest a little bit of time in that?
Sure. Well, that probably has to do with the bubble here in the Valley.
Well, yeah. No, and this is, you know, and but that bubble exists everywhere, right? I mean, you know, you go to an airline, they have their own bubble. That bubble's it's not unique to the Valley. I mean, sure, the Valley's got its thing. I grew up in Chicago. Chicago's got its thing. You know what I mean? You know, Portland has got its thing. It's kind of a cultural, you know, vibe. I think it's just more people just they it's hard to walk into a meeting. I mean, fundamentally, it's hard to walk into a meeting in your company and say that the other company has something better than us and not be seen as essentially somebody who's dissing your own product
right. By
bringing it up, or
exactly. You're
just seen as somebody who's spending your time not wisely. You know what I mean? You should be, you know, just making our product better. And I'm always like, yes, kind of. You know, the number of stories in business history where somebody basically came up on your contrail and smoked you. Just, you know,
right. There's
a lot of that. So I don't know why not looking in at seeing what the other guy's doing isn't a helpful thing, right? I mean, and we get, though, that you've got limited resources, right? It's like I've owned a business for 14 years. It's not like I can do everything I want to do every day, right? I mean, we get that. And I even tell people that I don't expect CI in most companies to be something, if they're small or medium-sized, that's kind of like the afterburner's always lit on. It may be something you turn on, you turn off, you turn on, and you turn off, but you just you have to have some process for that. Otherwise, you just very quickly get myopic, I think.
Yeah, you know, back in the day, I worked at a web authoring software company, and we used to do these things called product shootouts, where we would look at all the other contenders who were building or had products in the website authoring product space, and we would actually, there was a lab, there were third parties that would actually run the products through the paces on all the features and actually test how fast you could build the website using each of these products. And so we called them product shootouts, and that I don't see that happening a lot. Of course, with mobile apps, with a lot of the software startups in the social space, there isn't really other products positioned exactly the same way for them to compare against. What they don't realize, what I see a lot, is that even if there isn't another product, there is another way that people are solving the problem
exactly.
that product is solving. And so,
well, exactly. Right. I mean, there's this tendency to say, well, they're a mobile app and we're an HTML5 app, or we're a desktop app and we're this, or we're a cloud service and they're just this runty app, you know. And I look at it and think, at the end of the day, you know, Clayton Christensen wrote about this,
yep.
right? You know what I mean? In the inverse zone, he's like, the product exists to solve a job. That's the only reason they wrote you a check. Christensen didn't quite say it that way, but that, fundamentally, that's what it is, right? They wrote you a check because it solved a job. They're not in it because they believe in your business. They're not in it because they believe in where you're going. They don't want to send your kids specifically to whatever college you want to send them to. They wrote you a check because the product solves a job. And the second anything else can do that meaner, better, faster, and it's easy to switch over to, right? Classic
yeah.
stuff you talk about, like in a Porter's Five Forces, you know, what's the ability for buyers to switch products? What's the, you know, what's their ability to kind of invent their own solution, you know, through backward integration, you know, whatever. I mean, at some point, they just say, yeah, this other thing does a better job. And then everybody runs around going like, how did this happen? And I'm like, well, your product evolved to a point that was either more complex than what they wanted, or if you face a competitor that just found a way to do that job more efficiently than you were. And back in the day when you've got your first sales, that's the only thing they bought you for, right? And so now you're back in the same spot. And yeah, and I think people drift away from that, and that gets them into some pretty serious trouble after a while.
Yeah, we were discussing this last week. Jerry Rackley of Demand Metric was on. We were talking about positioning. And clearly, you need to know what your competitors are doing in order to position your product correctly. I think in order to determine what your market strategy should be, you really need to start with what the competitive space is, which used to be under the domain of the, quote, product marketer, unquote. Product marketing as a specific role or discipline is not talked about a lot. And as a matter of fact, Greg Gerasi is doing a study on product teams where he's looking at really how often product marketing versus product management versus business analysis versus CI, how often these are considered to be part of a product team and in what size organizations. So I'm thinking about this stuff all the time.
Yeah. No. It's one of those things where there's always that tension, and this is true of like almost in any dynamic, right? You could talk of any industry, any discipline. And there's always this tension between, you know, the world is changing, the way people buy products is changing. So hence, all the ways we used to do stuff, we're going to change all that. You know, and it's like, you know, I mean, you mentioned Atlassian's one of your guys' sponsors, right? You know, and I know a little bit about those guys. I mean, this is going to be a positive thing about it. Don't worry about that. But they you know, that one of their shticks is, you know, we don't have salespeople. That's in their marketing collateral, right? You know, they don't have salespeople. Well, sure you do. You just have salespeople who are different for them. You know, they sponsor stuff like this. They do other things. They market things. They have evangelists.
They have passionate.
Right. They have passionate users, right? So yeah. And eventually, if your company evolves to doing a certain type of sales model, you would probably need salespeople too, right? There's certain things. And so it's like there's these fundamental laws about, you know, understanding your environment and understanding your competitors and understanding what your value prop should be and understanding the value chain in an industry and all these things, right? They're still there. You know, it's the reason why Porter's Five Forces still exists as five forces and people try to stick an extra force on it every couple years and say, this is the one that's missing, isn't that those arguments aren't valid, right? Sure, it's valid to say these four forces in a pest analysis are not covered in Porter's and he forgot about them and we should talk about political. Sure, agreed. What's timeless about some of these frameworks is that they got to just the parts that mattered that were kind of always important.
Sure, they did.
You know what I mean? You always talk about buyers. And that's what makes them timeless.
Right, which is essential to any business who's in the business of creating revenue.
Right. Yeah, and just because, you know, you've got a new sales model or you've got a completely new product style or market or offering or segment you go after doesn't really change the fact that, you know, fundamentally people, you know, kind of still buy and interact with products much like they did, you know, before. It's just that they might have different vehicles and different ways to kind of make that happen. So, but anyway, so what other questions you got for us? Didn't mean to rat hole on this too long.
Yeah, no, so you had suggested questions having to do with all these different frameworks, and I wanted to step back and not assume that people were familiar with all these frameworks, because not everyone who's listening necessarily has an MBA and is familiar. We have a lot of small business owners and people across the board. So regarding the data that is being collected that companies have about the market, about their users, their buyers, how do you make sense of all the data you're collecting about your product, the market, and the competitors?
Yeah, and you brought up a great point, which is the notion of these frameworks, right? A lot of times people go from saying, well, I don't really know a whole lot about a competitor, and then they go out, they start, you know, focusing on ways to get more information, they get better at using Google, they find out about all these sites like SlideShare and Glassdoor and Indeed and, you know, everything that's sort of a staple of competitive intelligence. And then they have the opposite problem. They have too much data, and they're having a lot of trouble making sense out of it. And so that's where the frameworks come in. And the frameworks they shouldn't be seen really as an intimidating thing. They're just a methodological way of processing the data. And as Sean likes to say a lot of times, turn it into one slide, because a lot of times that's what you need. You need the quadrants, you need the graphs, you need the whatever it is that takes all of this information you've collected and synthesizes it into something that people can see and they have a visual representation of clearly what's going on. And so that could be something like a Porter's Five Forces that basically explains where and why profit is being made in an industry and where the power lies in an industry. Or it can be something like an ACH, an analysis of competing hypotheses, that lets people who have different predictions about what's going to happen in the future have an objective way of seeing where things are trending and come to agreement about, yeah, I guess this thing that I thought was going to happen, really there's no evidence to support it. All the evidence, you know, that comes in over the next 2 months really runs contrary to it. Or scenario planning, because one of the banes of competitive intelligence is people will say, well, I don't believe in competitive intelligence because nobody can predict the future. And the point isn't to predict the future. It's not a crystal ball job description. The point is to increase the odds of making a better decision. And so a really great framework for doing that is scenario planning, because you don't pick a future. You pick, you know, basically four futures based on some different uncertainties. And you can say, all right, let's assume we don't know what exactly the future holds. You know, maybe cloud computing will increase a little bit. Maybe it will increase a lot. Maybe people will move to mobile devices like, you know, the iPad instead of their laptop a little bit or a lot, right? So there's a spectrum of different things that can happen that you decide really have a lot of impact on your business. And then if you lay those out, you say, okay, well, what would we need to be successful in all of these features? Or which of these features are we just going to admit, okay, if that one comes true, we're just, you know, we're going to have trouble staying in business. We're not going to build for that particular future, but we ought to be able to have the key success factors we need for these three other ones.
Well, I want to chime in on one thing Scott said in the beginning, too, is that, you know, because as we go through these, there might be a tendency for folks to say, well, that does sound like it's a lot to learn. It does sound like a lot. And, you know, the thing is, we do workshops where in a couple days people pick up 10 new frameworks, right? You know, it's not complicated to understand it. What's challenging at times is making sure that you get the organization to orbit around this way of thinking, right? You know, because like you take a classic organization and they'll say, you know, let's go do a teardown of the competitor. And a teardown means make a spreadsheet with their features and ours.
Right.
That's not insight. That doesn't give you, that's, you know, and much less it gets out of date really quick. And it's not really consumable. And it's not flexible in the way that these frameworks are. And the other thing is we didn't invent these. I mean, we don't try to pick frameworks that like, I mean, we have invented a couple of ours, but just a couple, right? Where we thought there was a gap, right? You know, and we kind of use those on a project or whatever. But realistically, I'd rather use a framework that's been used like scenario planning since the Cold War. Shell used it for oil futures forecasting, and you can use for doing product development forecasting for 18 months out because people have for 20 years. You know, it's like something I end up saying a lot when we do our talk on open source intelligence collection that's kind of aligned with the book, you know, going by Google that we did. You know, somebody will raise their hand and say, I've never heard of that site. You know, and I'm always like, you know, the fact that you haven't heard of SlideShare isn't the fact that the site isn't visited. It's just that you haven't been there.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's kind of like these frameworks. It's like, and that's okay, right? It's not like you're at 18, somebody just pours a whole library's worth of knowledge in your head about everything you could ever possibly know about business, and you just know it all, right? So you have to be willing to learn. You know, Scott and I say to even our own kids a lot all the time. We're like, you know, just read. Because you want to be successful, read. You know what I mean? I, you know, my students at the university, they have to read a book a week for the industry analysis class. And they all act like, are you serious, prof? And I'm like, yeah, because how else are you going to learn? You know,
I think a lot of these people I meet right out of college, I don't know, they were born with a lot of this stuff embedded into them, a lot of this knowledge.
Well, sure, there's a little bit of that. But I mean, but the reality is, you know, a lot of these things, like Scott said, you can learn them. It might not even necessarily be anything more than buying a couple books and investing the time on the weekend and then having, you know, a little bit of the courage to say, the next time I build a deck, I'm going to build it using this framework, right? And I'm going to just commit to that. And that's when I go up to my next presentation to the development team, I'm going to say, this is how I organized my thoughts and this is what I did. And the funny thing is, most people, it's like when we were at that company that goes nameless that we were doing training on, you know, they one guy at the end of the day, this is literally the quote. He said, he looks at me and he says, you know, the typical at the end of a training day, you always say like, how did things go? Or you know, whatever, you say, thanks for coming or whatever. You hope obviously somebody says something nice when you're done, right? And so one of the guys said, I'm just so glad that we have tools. And Scott spot me on this, so I get it right. But I think he said something like that we have tools to make better sense of the data that we have.
Right.
There you go. That's all it is. You know, it's no different than, you know, if you're into programming, you create a library and you abstract stuff so you turn around and you can, you know, essentially have something that's an abstracted representation of X. You know, so we're pretty, it's probably coming across here from both of us. I mean, we're pretty passionate about the education side. We've always, both Scott and I, through our whole career, so speak for you, Scott, and then you can chime in on this, but we've always been guys, even when we had our first company, where we were always a little bothered by the organization that kind of made you feel like an idiot, and that was why you hired them. I was always like, "What? How is that working for you exactly?" I mean, and there's certain people who almost need they like that a little bit. They like the idea that the outside guy's way smarter than them or whatever. And I'm like, no. We're totally the we teach you how to fish kind of guys. We've always wanted to do that because I always felt, you know, I should work myself out of a job. That's the whole idea. But anyway, that's Scott. You could chime in on that too. But I know that's a part
thinking.
Of our ethos.
Right. That's mentor thinking. Consultant thinking. Well, actually, even a good leader and a good manager has that kind of orientation.
Yeah, I would agree. But go ahead. I'll let Scott take whatever the next one is. So give him some airtime too. So go ahead, Cindy.
So how do you distinguish between what information is essential and what is a distraction?
Yeah, and that again comes back to The thing to not lose sight of is, what is your key intelligence question? And a good key intelligence question is a question upon which some decision depends. Now, it can be a small decision. It can be, should I go meet with client A or client B tomorrow? Or it can be a major decision. It can be a decision that affects the need for 3 to 5 years. But ultimately, there should be some decision. And then there's a question that, if you had an answer to this question, will our competitor move into this market? Will they release a product that does X? Will they acquire company-Y? The answer to that question would have an impact on your decision. So at the point that you know the question, then you start saying, where does the answer lie? Will they buy this company? Well, where does the answer to that lie? Are they in the financial health to buy that company? Do they have a history of doing acquisitions? Have they made rumblings about doing these kinds of things? If you go look at the company that might get bought, is it doing strange things, like it has stopped all of its press releases, or all kinds of funny stuff that happens when a company is kind of in negotiation to be bought? So that's really how you filter out the noises. There will be all kinds of stuff that's very interesting, but it doesn't have any real bearing on the key intelligence question or the decision that's about to be made. And a problem is that a lot of times competitive intelligence departments turn into these stick-fetching organizations where people say, how many units of X did they sell last quarter? And, they just turn into this kind of reference library, and they're always being scattered around looking for this data point or that data point. And the ones that are effective usually push back on the people asking them questions and say, what are you trying to decide? Why does this answer matter? Why is this answer worth the resources to go get it?
Yeah, one other thing on just a little coda on that, too, is that, when we do scenario planning exercises, right, we give you a classic example that's from one of the frameworks. You almost have to be a little drill sergeant-esque, just a little, right? We're friendly guys. But, when you go do one of these and you say, your question for the scenario planning, your big question might be like, will we be able to own the SMB segment, to 40% in this space, blah, 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 right? I mean, invent segment plus product launch plus, competitive threat, and you've got some question that kind of puts that together. Classic thing people walk around in a conference room and ask themselves all day long. And so you'll do one of these as a workshop, or we will at least, and you get the folks to lay the question out. And then you start saying, well, what are your trends that impact this? And what are the uncertain things in the market, that impact this? And we start going through the steps of a structured scenario planning. And people will bring up all kinds of stuff. And you have to keep saying, does it impact that question? You know what I mean? Does it actually impact that question, what enterprises do? No. Does it impact that question, what happens in Brazil? No. Does it impact that question, what happens with that small upstart competitor you're all worried about, but it doesn't impact this question? And sometimes the frameworks, I think one of the things they do is they give you an excuse to fight. It's one of the reasons we call the talk we give on this a lot Fight Club, because it gives you an excuse to fight in a good way. You know what I mean? Because you get to say, well, the framework made me do it. I'm only asking questions about suppliers and substitutes because, it is one of the forces. We must consider substitutes here, right? Whereas otherwise, if you start to talk about substitutes, some guy in power or woman says, oh, we don't need to worry about that. But if you got the framework, you kind of feel like, we got to go through the whole thing, right? And all of a sudden people go, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, so it's the same that a product manager needs to have a roadmap. so they can stay focused on where the product is going,
yeah,
and push back for all the feature requests, so the product comes out.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. Well, and one thing on that, because I meant to bring this up at the start, and I want to, in case we don't bring it up later, is one of the things we have as kind of a resource on that, if folks wanted it, is we have these, we call them Fight Club guides, but they're basically different kind of, they're almost like a booklet that basically kind of lays out, here's a set of frameworks you can use to kind of fight more effectively. We actually call them kind of different rounds. So if anybody wants to get one of those, we give them away pretty freely when we do training, you know, so if somebody's hearing this and they're like, I'd love to know more about these, they could just send us an email and we could send them one. But the a lot of it, I think, is just giving you an excuse to do that, is because you've got a reason for why your findings got composed the way they did, and to be honest, you also just, even as an individual, don't accidentally skip over something, you know, you just don't. And in that way, it's like having a roadmap and having a requirements guide and all the other things that you would do. And you also don't forget segments, right? You know, you create personas because you don't want to forget what a customer really looks like. Well, in scenario planning, you put a rich narrative behind the scenario because you want to truly visualize what that worldview would be like and what it would be to live in it. So, you know, anyway, but microphone back to you. So what are the questions you got for us?
Okay, so you're speaking to this, but why is pattern recognition important for product success? So I pulled this out because we don't talk about pattern recognition enough outside of data people.
Yeah. Well, I think both of us will probably want to say something on this, so I'll keep my remarks short on the front end, and then Scott can chime in. I think for me, and I say this a lot, and I say this to folks when I teach them at the university, I even say it in corporate training when we do it, I say it all the time, is you can't be a good analyst unless you can have good pattern recognition skills. And everybody knows this intuitively, right? The guy you know who always seems to know what's happening next always seems to be able to recognize the pattern before everybody else. That's good pattern recognition, right? Somebody who doesn't is the guy who's always wrong in predicting the future, right? And so if you... people who are good at pattern recognition have a way of positioning and organizing kind of a couple things that aren't really strong signals into something that's more meaningful than that. And part of it can be taught, part of it's innate. That's one time where I would say that you can learn some of the patterns, but your ability to kind of use them effectively varies a little bit. And that's just normal, right? Anybody can learn how to code. Some people code better than others. Right, so there's, you know, for that analogy. But Scott, you might want to chime in on this too. I have a feeling.
No, I'm good.
Okay.
So, you know, when you talk about pattern recognition in that way, it sounds like people who come up with battle strategies would be good at competitive intelligence, or certainly they're good at recognizing patterns from the data that they're getting in warfare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's be honest, right? I mean, I am a huge military history buff. I've always been. I tell Scott sometimes that when I moved into this part of my career life, you know what I mean? Because I obviously wasn't doing CI at 21. You know what I mean? I'm 42. You know, little did I know that I would be able to use all of the, you know, military history analogies in a whole different and unique way occasionally. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of that applies. But it's not exclusively that, though. I mean, you know, business is not 100% combat. You know, there's co-opetition frameworks. You know, one of the things we teach in training we do, and I teach at the university, is, you know, co-opetition and co-innovation frameworks. So you could read, you know, frameworks from the wide lens. You could read co-opetition, which was a really popular book a while back that talks about parts and game theory and all, you know, the parts framework and game theory and things like that. So you know, it's not, but in that way, it's also a little bit like, you know, politics and diplomacy, right? You know, before the war, there was a lot of negotiation, and there was a lot of alliances made and things like that. So, yeah, there's definitely some parallels there for sure.
And it can be pretty honestly counterproductive to fall into the business as war style of thinking. Competitive intelligence, honestly,
isn't about beating the competition in a lot of ways. I mean, people think about that. That's a fine sort of shorthand for how to think about it. But ultimately, the goal is to delight the customer. And so whoever delights the customer the most with the best product, the least price, the most availability, the best service, the most innovative thinking, delivering things to the customer that they didn't even know they wanted, they're the ones who are going to win. And it's not a zero-sum game. War is a zero-sum game, right? There's a certain amount of territory on the planet, and one country either controls a spot of land or another country does. But competition isn't. I mean, we are making progress. We're growing new markets. We're doing those kinds of things. And so you need to understand the competition innately if you want to delight the customer more than somebody else is. But it isn't really about putting that guy out of business.
Right, exactly.
It's more about making that guy irrelevant.
Right.
Because you're doing something that they either can't or won't do themselves.
Well, and the irrelevancy comes back from that thing that you brought up, Cindy, about, you know, there's a job to do, right? I mean, and that's, I think, where we can come full circle on that point is that, you know, we're always looking in what we do for what's the job our client's product is trying to do and what's the job that the other guy's product is trying to do. And to Scott's point, is one of these about to make the other one irrelevant, right? In some way, right? And that's it. But it's not, and I think it's real important Scott brought this up. It's the reason it's important to not think about it as in, you know, we're trying to kill the other guy or take him out or whatever. And it's easy to fall into that a little bit sometimes too, it's not spy versus spy. That we're not, like I joke occasionally with rooms when they ask, like, well, what are the disciplines that you kind of borrow skill sets from to be a good CI analyst? I'm like, well, it's investigative reporting, some market research skills, some from public sector intelligence agencies, although we don't get to do waterboarding. You know, there's certain things you don't get to do. You know what I mean? There's something called SIGINT, which is signals intelligence. If you do that in business terms, you go to jail. That's called tapping a phone line, so you're not allowed to do that. You know, there's things that essentially are off limits, right? Because it isn't war. It isn't, no matter what I do, it's all okay because I'm fighting for God and country kind of thing, right? It's not that, you know. And sometimes the decision might be that everything you learn about the market tells you it would be better to partner with somebody, right? And so you got to be okay with that answer, because sometimes that's your next 3 years basically has partner, co-innovate, and co-opetition written on top of it, right? And if you're too obstinate to really go with that, you may be missing out on really the best opportunity you have.
Yeah, see, this is key, and I think it's missing a lot in the product manager's toolkit, that they're not. We need to be looking further out strategically when thinking about even the next product features. What is the exit goal? Will we be partnering? You know, where will the distribution be? What will the exit be? And I find too often here in Silicon Valley, the exit plan is just to be acquired. It's not about the product, even though the startups think it's about the product. There's a bigger game being played on them, but that's a different conversation. So let's get back to.
But you're on to something there, though. I would agree. There's absolutely. Maybe bring us back, and we'll talk about entrepreneurship another time, and we'll talk about that one. But go ahead. What are the questions?
Yeah,
you got?
But by the way, this is the last broadcast of 2012, which we've had phenomenal growth in the audience. Last week we had over 23,000 listeners, which is very exciting. So for 2013, I'm looking at doing, in addition to the podcast, more other digital events and panel discussions on Google Hangouts, and really tackling some big issues. A lot of what I've been doing on the broadcast is educating people about product management issues and knowledge, and so this is great, and we will definitely have you back. One of the things I wanted you to explain, in your frameworks, you talk about the OODA loop. What is the OODA loop, and how does it affect strategy?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I actually even hate that it's called the OODA loop. You know, it's kind of like right up there saying Web 2.0 or something. It's like I grimace. You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, just because it sounds so silly, right? You know what I mean? To call it OODA. I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, what's that? So the OODA loop actually is another one of these frameworks that's kind of tried, true, and tested. And this one in particular actually probably has the biggest connection out of really any of the ones we typically mention to folks from like a military public sector side. So there was this guy, Boyd, who basically had this incredible insight back in the roughly 60s or 70s. I've read his biography, but I'm trying to remember the exact decade that he started the whole thing. And the challenge he was facing was we were building these huge fighter jets that had swing wings and they went Mach 2, but they couldn't turn worth a lick. And they were designed to basically carry big payloads, you know, when the world ended, you know, and we were going to go bomb the Soviets and they were going to bomb us. Well, then Vietnam happened and everybody started dogfighting and nobody was dropping nuclear weapons. They were actually dogfighting and it looked, you know, a little bit like Top Gun, right? And so all of a sudden, these big, fast, but not really turnable planes, not very maneuverable, were getting shot down with a certain amount of regularity. So Boyd said, what's going on here? What's the challenge that we're facing? Why can't I communicate the problem I see to the higher-ups? Because you haven't seen an organization that won't listen sometimes till you've seen the U.S. military or public sector organizations, right? I mean, you know, you think you've got, you know, bureaucracy issues working in a 10-person startup. You don't know what you're talking about. So you know, Boyd says, how in the world do I have this make sense? And so what he came to distill a decade's worth of this guy's research right into 60 seconds. He said, well, all right, every competitive environment basically has this one piece of it that happens over and over again. So two fighter jets face off, and he says, you have to observe the other guy. You have to orient to where he is. Is he climbing, diving, coming out of the sun, whatever, right? You know, from a business sense, is this guy moving fast? Is he got experience in, you know, a lot of global markets? Is he mostly a U.S. base? You know, so that's orienting to it. You know, obviously initially even noticing they're there, right, that you have competition. And then deciding to do something about it and then acting on it. The last two was honestly a pretty brilliant insight, probably because he worked in the government. He realized that the gap between decide and act could be decades long. You know, we've decided to do something, but the actual action takes 20 years to happen. And so out of this, what he essentially helped create was what they called the lightweight fighter project, which ended up being the F-16 and the F-15, and even to some degree the F-18 that the Navy flies. And so they became very maneuverable aircraft that could very effectively shoot down the opposition. And we one of these classic things where when you're walking around the building saying, we'll make a decision about that after the reorg settles, and you've been reorging for 15 months, well, you have a longer OODA loop. That's you have essentially stopped deciding and acting. Or if you turn off any kind of view of the competitive landscape because you're so focused on saying it only matters what our product does, you've stopped observing. You've stopped orienting. Yes, you're deciding and you're acting, but you're not doing the whole loop. And so Boyd's, you know, to tie it together, Boyd's argument was if the other guy goes through his OODA loop faster than you, basically you get shot down and he lives. And it was a really compelling insight because I think a lot of businesses don't have a way to describe that challenge they're facing, right? Whether it's a reorg or it's you just get kind of gummed up with your own process or you have a long development cycle and you can't ever get the product out the door. You know, if you drew this and you said, this is where we're stuck, it's a much better way of having the argument than necessarily just always arguing about how late the product development cycle is. So that's Boyd, and that's what the OODA loop's all about.
Wow. So could you draw a parallel between OODA and lean customer development? Because basically they're testing hypothesis, and then they're pivoting in response to the data they're getting back.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot of frameworks that probably mimic it in some ways. I mean, agile product development, you know what I mean? The whole idea that you're anything along those lines where you're kind of trying to build a framework that allows you to observe, orient, decide, act really fast. You know what I mean? And then do it again and do it again and do it again. Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of that. And that's why those frameworks by, you know, fairly successful for most companies, because they're forcing them to go through that decision cycle a lot faster every time. And, you know, in the classic case, right, the reason why the small upstart competitor usually kills the large company, I mean, in a lot of cases, is because they can go through that OODA loop faster than the larger company. You know, they're iterating so much faster. So anyway.
Wow. And our intro talk, our cycle, our loop has gone very quickly today. We're coming to the end of the hour. And we're only halfway through the questions, but you did give us a great orientation into understanding the power of competitive intelligence, which I really appreciate. So definitely, thank you, Sean. I did tweet out that people could get access to your book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book? And I will tweet out you gave me the link.
So basically, the easiest way to get the book is to go to cascadeinsights.com/request. We have a book that's now in its third edition, will be in its fourth in the spring, on open source intelligence collection. It's called Going Beyond Google, Gathering Internet Intelligence. It was listed as a must read, even it's an initial edition by SCIP, the Strategic and Competitive Intelligence Professional Association. And the only way to get it is to contact us. That is a little bit by design. I guess that's our own version of marketing. So, you know, feel free to reach out to us if you go to the request page and sign up. We're more than happy to send you a copy just for attending the talk today. And then I also mentioned earlier the Framework Fight Club handbooks, essentially. Those are also available if somebody wants those. You know, feel free on those to just send us an email directly as well, in addition to the sign up. I already got a couple emails, it looks like, from folks already on that subject. So, and, you know, and as you mentioned earlier, we also have a podcast of our own called CI Life that's on iTunes, where we cover a lot of these things. And, just, you know, been great to be here. Looking forward to chatting with you folks again next year. And, I guess that's it from our end.
Great. And I added your podcast to, I curated a list of product management related podcasts that are currently being done, as well as past ones, because they're still relevant. So you are on the list. And I really appreciate how you make them short and sweet. So they're little tidbits that are easy to digest. It's an education in competitive intelligence. So definitely check out the CI Life podcast. Thank you so much, Sean Campbell from Cascade Insights, for joining us today. And Scott Swigart, please come back. Sean recently did a webinar for the AIPMM, which is our platinum sponsor. Visit the AIPMM.com and subscribe to the newsletter to get updates on events and webcasts and resources coming up in 2013. That's at www.AIPMM.com/subscribe. And join us in person in San Francisco on February 7th is the Startup Product Summit, an all-day event with people from startups talking about their experience of dealing with product at all the phases that the product has to go through. It's an intimate summit, an intimate event for people in startups and interested in learning about startups and how product teams work together. That's at startupproduct.com. And there is also a product innovation leadership training happening in San Francisco on February 5th and 6th from the AIPMM. Go to AIPMM.com under certifications and PDUs to find out more about that. Thank you to the audience for listening. Thank you to the tweeters for tweeting the information for getting the book, Going Beyond Google, Gathering Internet Intelligence, has been tweeted out. Just search for or follow at PRODMGMTTALK to get that information. And join us in 2013. There will be a lineup of great speakers and new events, digital events happening. This is Cindy F. Solomon. Thank you so much for an excellent year. I have learned so much every year. We continue to pivot, to expand the discussions, and let's see. I'm just so grateful for a great year. Thanks so much to Scott, Sean, all the listeners, and follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, and you will get updates for the first talks in 2013.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks. Have a great week.
As a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network, we receive 10,000 listens per week. Imagine your brand engaged with our audience for over 50 minutes on their personal devices. Sponsor us. Email sponsor@PRODMGMTTALK.com for more information. Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Discover how to work together to develop amazing products. Startup Product Summit, February 7th, 2013. Startupproduct.com. Our intro theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco. We are broadcasting live from Studio 132.com.